Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 106 with the title, An Ordinary Bloke with an Extraordinary Mission. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome Stephen Whitten. Stephen is the founder, Menable, speaker and professional MC. When I asked Stephen to describe his superpower, he said it is spreading joy and saving the world one smile at a time. Hello, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Joanne, hi. And I'm so keen to get stuck in. I interrupted you. So apologies. Yes, it's absolutely, I'm delighted to be here. And that's my joyful radio voice. Or I could be an ordinary bloke and just go, yeah, thanks for having me. It's brilliant. It's going to be great.
It's all right, Steve. I mean, I had to have one eventually, I suppose. Yeah. No, I'm really excited. I mean, we've known each other now a couple of years and I'm looking forward to this conversation to find out more about you and what makes you tick. And I suspect you're not just an ordinary bloke on an extraordinary mission. There's more to you than that. So tell me more.
Yeah, do you know what? The ordinary bloke thing actually came from a mutual friend of ours, Jackie Handy. And we were having a chat one day and I was talking about the challenges of life and where I'd come from and what had happened to me and all that stuff. And she actually said to me, she said, you know what, your real superpower is that you're an ordinary bloke. You look, sound and act like a very typical, you know, white, middle-aged, hopefully middle class. I don't know what that means anymore, but guy on the street, you're just ordinary. You could be working in a car dealership or in a supermarket or driving a bus or working in an office or running a big business, you know, just an ordinary guy. But yeah, you're right, with what I hope is an extraordinary mission, which came to me through some really dark times, actually, which I'll get onto in a bit. But so that's what I'm all about. And most recently, the latest sort of incarnation of that journey and my evolution is exactly as you said in the intro, which is about now properly realizing that my destiny, which I think is a step above purpose, but you know, the ultimate one is the destiny is about spreading joy and literally trying to do that one smile at a time, you know, saving the world by one person smiling at a time. So
I love that. I mean, ordinary bloke. Yeah. As I know you, I can see that in you, that you are in an unremarkable package. But as I say, I know that there's more to you than that. And, you know, you're, and I can see you driving a bus, but I can really see you in a car dealership, because isn't that your background?
Yeah, it is totally. I started in a car dealership when I was 18. Absolutely loved it. It was an act of rebellion because I'd gone through school and I'd done quite well academically, given that I was at a school that wasn't renowned for its academic prowess. Very ordinary secondary modern school in Aylesbury in Buckinghamshire, where I grew up, having moved out of London when I was a kid. And I went into the car trade, and my parents at the time would have had me go into a factory or do something along their line of work. So because I went into something that to them was a lot more glamorous, that was almost a sort of my first act of rebellion. Now, interestingly, I rebelled at them because they said, oh, we'll get you a job at the factory we work in. And I said, I don't want to work anywhere that's cold, damp, greasy, smelly and full of blokes. So I ended up in a car dealership, which was cold, damp, greasy and full of blokes. But the act of rebellion was I got to drive flash cars and take them home occasionally and sort of, you know, rub it in my parents' face that there was me at a young age, you know, a flash young man in the early 80s doing that stuff.
I think you shared a photograph on social media not so long ago of you sort of leaning on the bonnet of a car. Mm. I think you put the caption, "Me in my younger days, same smile, just more hair," or something.
I think it said something like 4 stone ago and a lot more hair. And it was a Ford Cortina that we had for sale on the forecourt, which kind of gives my age away a little bit as well. But yeah, and that's where it all started. And despite my protestations of wanting to get away from the car industry, it still kind of drags you back in.
Yeah. It must give me a lot of life skills. You know, you're quite a chatty, engaging, ordinary bloke. Yeah. And I guess the car dealership gives you that kind of background in talking the hind legs of a donkey and just engaging and talking, having conversations.
Well, it did. But I think, I look back on it now, and I think my main survival tactic as a child in what was a very vibrant, very opinionated, very working class family. And I mean, in the early days, my parents were very young when they had me. So we had to live with my grandparents, and they still had offspring that were living at home. So there was like this sort of big group of adults and one small child that learned very quickly, probably, that in order to get the attention, I had to be as gobby as some of the adults. And so I think by the time I was 6 or 7, I was probably quite an irritating, precocious little child that if I saw walking around a shop now, I'd walk away from. But yeah, so I think that's where it started. And I think the car industry then just promoted that and gave me a platform to be even worse.
Was it mainly kind of dealerships for big manufacturers, or was it the car showroom on the corner pumping out the sort of the Canardleys, if you like?
Yeah, it was worse than that. It was not quite a back street used car dealership, but it was a used car dealer in a village that had probably 15 to 20 used cars in stock. And we had a Skoda franchise as well, another part of the business, which was just down the road. And of course, back then, Skoda, but that was back in the day where it had a terrible reputation. You know, it was one of those sort of Eastern Bloc countries that no one went anywhere near, except unless you wanted to buy a brand new car and you had no money to buy it with. So we did quite well with that. But then, yeah, I moved out of the motor trade for a couple of years and then went back into it working for Vauxhall Finance, which was owned by General Motors. So Vauxhall's own finance company, doing collections and debt recovery and stuff like that. And they must have thought, well, this guy's got some good dealer background. We'll make him an area manager. So I became the youngest area manager they'd ever had, and driving around in my Vauxhall Carlton. Don't know if you remember those. I got that as a company car. So there was me. I think I was like 22, 23, and I was driving around a Vauxhall Carlton. I thought I was Billy Big Watsit, and which, of course, then it rubbed it on in my parents' face even more.
Was that debt collection and repos and stuff, was it?
That's what I started off doing with them. And then after a year, I got promoted into an area manager's job, and I just did not have a clue what I was doing. I mean, it was shockingly bad, really. You know, arse from elbow is an understatement. I just did not have a clue. How I blagged my way through that is anyone's guess. But hey, I looked good. I was driving a lovely car. I eventually did, the light bulb did go on eventually, and I did get to work out what I was doing. And then that then progressed me into another 10 or 11 years working in that kind of environment before I stepped out and went self-employed and started doing training and all that sort of stuff. And then, of course, as you know,
training to the motor industry.
Yeah, predominantly. Yeah, predominantly, which was, you know, again, despite my protestations, I always think, at the time I was like, well, I want to get out of the car industry. But the more you do, the more you realize that your credibility is within that one sector in the main, doing that type of work anyway. And actually, when you go into other organizations, you think that, you know, it's the same crap, different wallpaper, basically.
Tell me a bit about Menable, because that figures in sort of towards the end of your story. Then we can figure out how you got from where you were to there, and talk about a bit about the joy. You know, how did you discover that you needed to bring joy to the world because you didn't necessarily have it yourself? Is that how it turned out?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the bit where it takes a bit of a dip, so brace yourselves. Effectively, what happened was, I go back a tiny bit. I knew as a teenager, bear in mind I was a teenager in the early 80s, sort of 81, 82, that I knew I was curious about my sexuality. But back then, we didn't talk about it. And those that did came out fully as gay or hid it and didn't say or do anything. But I know that there were other boys of my age that were curious as well. And, you know, because of the sort of, dare I say, heteronormative part of that, managed to create a life that was normal in the face of the society, if you like. So, yeah, so project forward 30 odd years working in the car industry. I'd got married, and I met and married the prettiest girl in the village when I was working in the car dealership. We got married very young. We had two children fairly quickly. We had the mortgage, we had the house, we had all the bits and pieces. And the car industry and everything I was doing in it facilitated that. But working in that industry also meant that you were under pressure, stressed, anxious about where your next paycheck was coming from, how big it was going to be and all that stuff. And with all that in mind, eventually that was a bubble that ended up bursting, and in the most unpleasant, horrible way that I can imagine. And, you know, to this day, I still live with the regret and the hate for what happened there, and you know, the remorse for what my now ex-wife and my one child in particular feel that I did by coming out, by declaring the truth and being authentically me. So 2020 was the year of the pandemic, as we know. Business fell over completely that I'd built up by that stage. My marriage disintegrated, my family broke up, and I came out at the same time. So it was like, well, there's nothing else that can go. What could possibly go wrong now? Or we'll just throw bankruptcy into that mix as well. Oh, hang on a minute. Here comes a solicitor with some divorce papers. That'll do the trick. But yeah, so that's where I went. And then during the course of 2020, I realized that I wasn't the only person of a certain age in the car industry that had had those issues. So I reached out to some leaders and said, look, got this idea. I think we need to support our colleagues. What do you think? And immediately picked up some fantastic supporters and some great people who became advocates and ambassadors for us. And so that's how the Men Able movement began. So does that answer your question?
Yeah. So you say you look back on it and it was a dark time and things didn't go as smoothly as you'd hoped. You said you had some sort of regrets, or certainly around your family, if you like. So on reflection, where what could you have done differently, or where did it go wrong? Was it the stress you were under? Was it just...
Yeah, I mean, well, I suppose regret's a big word, isn't it? What I think I should have done was to have been brave enough and big enough to have owned it when I was 18 and be honest with, you know, the people around me. But at that time I was fearful, you know, and the fact that it was, you know, not a completely sort of totally gay or totally straight thing, that it was easy for me to sort of cover one part of that up and just do. And outside of that, you know, I'm not, that sound, you know, my ex-wife will say that's manipulative and all that. It's not. It genuinely is the case that I met her, fell in love with her, loved her and adored her deeply. And so at that point was like, no, this is, you know, it's, let's put that other bit in a box and leave it there. But of course, it didn't stay there, did it? It simmered away. And, you know, and then when the conversation happened, when it literally was timed with the pandemic and the business collapsing and having all of that as well, I didn't get the reaction from a few people, including my ex-wife, that I thought I would have done. I don't know why. I don't know why I believed or naively thought that she would be like, oh, okay, that's fine. You know, well, now I just know something more about you that I didn't know before. Let's go to Tesco's. I didn't expect that, but I didn't expect the reaction that I did get. Mm. What that did do was sent me down a very dark path of thinking, well, and I don't mean to trigger anyone who's listening here, but, you know, that there were a couple of points where I thought a fast-moving train's got more appeal than dealing with this rubbish. Yeah. And it's only when you get there that you think, yeah, that's not me, you know.
People often ask me, would I do things differently if I had my life again, things like this. And I always say that I love my family. My coming out story was not a smooth ride, but the result has been very positive. But people often say, yeah, what would you do differently? And I said, well, I wouldn't change a thing, because I've got two fantastic children that wouldn't be alive, wouldn't be in my life now, wouldn't be amazing had I done something different at the age of 18, 17 or 15 or 10 or whatever years old. So yeah. I have to say, I would not change a thing, because Otherwise, I wish their erasure, if you like. And I think that always keeps me focused that, yeah, I've had a whole life. I've had a big life. I'm sure you've had an amazing life doing what you were doing, building that family. But it's difficult to regret your child's birth.
Oh, yeah, no, and I don't regret that at all. I mean, I think I still would have gone ahead and, you know, that would have happened. But what it would have done is given me the chance, you know, to make the right choices way back then, and also give my now ex-wife, as I say, the chance to make an informed decision as well.
Mm. It's so not that easy when everything comes together, you say the pandemic, the business failing, your awakening to your own identity and something to do about that. It's everything kind of car crashes at once sometimes, doesn't it? And you want to just start again.
Well, yeah, that was exactly it. That was exactly it. And, you know, to be my age, you know, at the time, what, 53, to then be facing, you know, financial ruin, which some would argue was self-imposed, but also, you know, that disintegration of a loving family environment and, you know, losing the person that you would hope to have grown old with, you know, all of that together. And that's not a woe is me story. That's just getting to a point of accepting that's the realistic situation that happened. You know, there's lots of other stuff that obviously I wouldn't share that obviously she knows about that, you know, she would argue, well, that was the crux of it all. Because again, that's the other thing that the motor trade does, is it the divorce rates are very high because paint in the bits in between the lines what you want. But suffice to say, when you put a lot of people together in the same environment and they're stressed and anxious and under pressure, they can have a tendency to take solace in each other. You know what I'm saying? And so, of course, you throw that into the mix as well. And suddenly it's a bit of a hotbed for, you know, all sorts of stuff to happen. I'm sure that's not unique to the car industry. I hear a lot about that in other industries as well. But, you know, yeah, all of that. And everything, as you say, collapsed at the beginning of 2020. And that was my year to go, well, I either genuinely do go off and reinvent myself as a bus driver and go and do something else, or think seriously about what can I do. And once I'd started the ball rolling with Menable, and I could see that actually, yeah, I've got something here. This is where it started to feel that I was now fulfilling my purpose for the first time ever.
So Menable, just tell us a bit about what sparked it. I mean, you've given us a bit of a hint, you know, what was the kind of the big idea? What's its purpose? And who does it have most success with at the moment?
So it was coming from the point of, I want to do something that supports predominantly men in the industry, but then realizing very quickly that actually this isn't a unique thing to men. And actually one of the reasons that then the industry has a big problem with recruiting in its own likeness. It also has a big problem with diversity and inclusion. There's lots of work going on in this area, but it's still a very male-dominated, masculine industry. And as a result, we're not attracting the right people, and we're not keeping the right people. So this point about mental health became rapidly about diversity and inclusion and inclusivity and equity and everything else. And I then coined a phrase which was, if we want to achieve diversity and inclusion in the automotive industry, we have to address men's mental health, because what's going on there, and the reason that we have homophily, which is the, you know, recruiting in your own likeness, the reason that we have that is that there are an awful lot of men who have progressed into senior positions and out of fear or lack of confidence or low self-esteem or whatever it is, what they do, because they don't want to take a risk and they don't want to put their own situation in jeopardy, what they end up doing is they continue to recruit people who look, sound and act like them. So someone comes along who's a bit different, a bit quirky, doesn't look like them, hasn't got the same background, doesn't dress like them, whatever it might be. So that person comes along and suddenly that poses a, ooh, that's going to be a challenge. You know, actually what I want is somebody who can drop in a seat and get up to speed quickly. Now that doesn't work either, because what we end up with in the car industry is a revolving door. And people that go from business to business to business, and I've said it a few times, we get, you know, a guy will go for a job and he's say, you know, he wears as a badge of honor the fact that he's done 18 months with that business and 6 months with that one and 2 years there and 3 years there. Well, that's not a badge of honor. That's telling you something. That's a pattern. So Menable set out with that initial men's mental health thing. rapidly became about diversity and inclusion. As rapidly now we evolved that to become about mental wealth, not mental health, because that's about in everything around getting people to have the right energy and the right approach to this. And like I said, in the most recent few days or weeks, we're starting to talk more about, well, what brings you joy? You know, let's not focus on the dark down stuff, because no one wants to talk about that, but let's focus on what you can do to be more positive and upbeat.
All male or engineering or workshop type environments or dealership environments that you describe tend to be, as you say, filled by a monoculture, a typical ordinary bloke type. And the environment can, all male environments can be quite toxic and survival of the fittest, the alpha male, and everyone sort of falling in behind. You know, you see the stereotypes. It's quite a cruel environment if you're different. And I think, you know, maybe not today, but certainly not too distant past, being queer, being gay, being bi was a weakness that people used to latch on. I've heard of stories about people locking people in cupboards and things because they were gay or, you know, in the aim of banter and all good fun and a bit of a laugh.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I still hear the odd little story about it, but the key one is the microaggressions. You know, it's the questions and it's the comments that get aimed at you. And I've never had any of that. And part of that is because I recognized that I was probably part of that engine of throwing out that banter, in inverted commas. But also that ordinary bloke thing is actually, I use that to effect, because I'll start off a talk or a conversation with a group and I'll just act and look and sound as I am, but I'll wear a pink shirt with matching socks and pink laces and notice that one or two people in the room have clocked that and go, hang on a minute, this guy's a bit different. And then I'll flash my rainbow bracelet and I'll, you know, act up being a bit camp and throw a few gay innuendos in there and suddenly just say to them, look, I'm in the most masculine environment you could be in, but I really don't give a shit. I don't care. You know, you can throw whatever you want at me, but just do not throw that banter and that stuff at a 17-year-old person, boy or girl, who's come to work in your business to do an apprenticeship because they want to, you know, work with cars. And suddenly they find that they're in an environment where, you know, that conversation over coffee, have you got a girlfriend then, Jamie? Come on, who are you out? Are you out on Saturday night? You're going to pull a few birds? And so Jamie now can't say, well, no, actually, because, you know, I'm gay and I've got a boyfriend, because the environment is too, if it's not toxic, it's certainly not safe to do that. If you are like I was, a 17, 18-year-old lad who, one, is questioning it, and two, thinks this is dangerous for me to, you know, not dangerous in a physical harm way, although that could be the case, but dangerous certainly mentally.
Really tough culture to kind of overcome, because it's so ingrained and so part of the way it is, if you like. And it's not surprised that, you know, you almost have to fix the problem before you can change the problem. It's that chicken and egg, isn't it? How do you dilute the culture with difference when difference is driven out?
Well, you asked me at the beginning of that, I was conscious I didn't quite answer the question previously, which was about what successes are we having with that? The point is that where we got to was that to go out there and say, look, the culture needs to change. This is about culture, you know, and I've got it was a great phrase used by a politician a few weeks ago, which is no one likes the guy that shouts iceberg. And for the last 3 years, I've been that guy that's shouting iceberg, whilst parts of the car industry have been, well, let's just get our deck chairs back in the right place, you know, on a sinking ship sort of thing. And as a result, we're now talking about, oh, we're not recruiting enough people. We're not keeping the right people. We're not doing this. We're not doing that. So one of the things that I did with Men Able was created an accreditation program called Wellbeing Winners. And what we do with that is we go in and we do an assessment and we look at this from a perspective of wellbeing. Now, one of my great supporters actually said that the problem you've got, Steve, is that you're going to an industry with a solution to a problem they don't perceive they have. And I was like, wow, yeah. And that stuck with me, because the point is what they do, and there's a charity that the industry relies on, they're great, they do a great job. But what we've got is big companies that will happily pay big lumps of money to them every year and put posters on the wall saying, if you've got a problem, ring this number. Or they'll have a charity cake sale or whatever it might be. But what they're not getting to is the crux of the issue that at a management level, you're still employing guys like me who were or are aggressive bullies, you know, have got to take the wrong kind of approach, if that makes sense. Now, I like to think that's changing, but it's not changing quickly.
Yeah, I've done some work with big organisations, the defence contractors and car manufacturers, and they have a very similar problem with the shop floor, the hourly paid as opposed to salary people, that culture is so deep and so ingrained that even now, and these are big organisations who have major, you know, D&I programs, HR teams, big corporate-y type environments, and they still struggle to evolve the culture. I'm not saying they haven't made any difference, but it is that iceberg, yeah, or the ship. How do you turn around a supertanker and avoid the iceberg? You've got to stop first before you can go backwards, or before you can maneuver. And that's the real challenge. It's almost generational to make some of these changes.
It is generational, and I've said as well that, you know, take the car industry. When you're geared up for mass production, somewhere along the line you're going to have targets and you're going to have objectives. And if you are the kind of person that's grown up in one industry, you probably only know of one or two ways to deliver those objectives. And that's where we get the familiarity, the same old, and, you know, very few people are prepared to take a bit of a risk and go, let's try something a bit different here. Let's try this a different way. Let's employ some different people. You know, I went and had a breakfast with somebody the other day in a garden center, and the waitress, you know, one side of her hair was blue, the other side was pink. She was wearing dungarees and she had what looked like a paperclip hanging out of her ear. I do not, and I thought to myself, she'd be great in front of customers because she was wonderful with us. And I thought, I don't know any managers in the industry I've described that would go, I'm going to employ her as a car salesperson.
Especially not in the premium tier, you know, the BMW, the Mercedes, the Audi, the Bentley. It just wouldn't happen, would it?
Nope. And yet she'd be brilliant. She'd be brilliant.
On the used car forecourt, maybe, but not on the not in the premium brands. And I did some work with a global clothing brand, and I was at the bar the night before the main do, and people were talking about their branch recruitment policy, and they said, oh yeah, I saw something the other day, and they just weren't our brand. They had this and they had that, and I thought, wow, you've judged that person on appearance. Because they didn't meet your culture, your brand. Mm. I think, you know, you argue about it's brands and culture fit and all these kind of things. But somehow you have to, in order to break the mold, you have to break the mold. And that sounds like an oxymoron. But you have to be decisive that you're looking for change. Because you'd be surprised how many customers go, wow, well done, fantastic, fabulous.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's just like my daughter. She's just like my son. And
yeah.
Do you think we value, and I use the phrase gifted jerk for want of a better way of describing it, is that you get people who are maybe top salespeople, you know, the Jack the Lad, the King of the Hill, you know, the almost the invincible, can't fire them because they are lifeblood. They keep the ship afloat. But they are then allowed to get away with everything they do. You know, we can't say anything to them because they're our top salesperson. And of course, as long as you give permission for that person to continue and not challenge them or risk them walking, then you're never going to break that change, are you?
Do you know what? I see that a lot, and I've heard that a lot over the years, and even recently with one of the you know, really progressive businesses that we're working with. They took the well-being winners. They're doing everything that we've asked them to do, but there's still an element of, oh, well, yeah, but I've got one sales, and it always begins with the phrase, yes, but, right? But yes, but I've got one sales exec, one salesman, who sell, you know, he's got lots of flaws and he may not do this and do that, but he sells 25 cars a month, you know. And then you go, well, yeah, but what's the trail of destruction that he's leaving? Because his customer service measurements are crap. His profitability is rubbish. His part exchange appraisals are poorly done. And yes, he might sell 25 cars a month, but actually how many potential customers is he pissing off in the meantime? Because he won't talk to them unless they're actually going to buy a car that day. And so you're getting customers coming in who are not having a great experience and they're going to shop somewhere else or eventually shopping online, you know.
So it's almost an industry thing. You as an industry have got to call that out. And make an independent stand and say, yeah, this person isn't working, and then give them a bad reference.
Yeah, but it's an iceberg.
I know.
Do you know what I mean? It's that. And, you know, and I think the point about the lovely girl that served me last week with the blue and pink hair is that what will happen if she went for a job at one of these places. And I got to say, not all, because there are a lot of very progressive ones that, you know, they're not, I'm tarring them all with the same brush. It's not all the same. But the vast majority would look at her and they wouldn't embrace the difference. They'd see the deficit, which is a phrase that I think Harvard used around this whole thing about DEI. And I love that. I just think that is so true, that we don't embrace what's different and unique and beautiful about this person. All we see is there's a deficit. Yes, but I can't put her in front of customers because they will make a judgment. No, they won't. You know, the 90-year-old bloke who comes in and she doesn't look anything like he's used to, well, if they're going to make a judgment, they're going to make a judgment about anything. So they're going to make a judgment about a girl with pink or blue hair. Equally, they're going to make a judgment about a 57-year-old guy with pink socks and pink laces, which is why I do it.
when I first came out, going back to 2007, so it's 7 odd years ago, I was scratching around looking for some income, as you do when you first go out on your own. I was one of my network called out for looking for an associate who could help them with this workplace ergonomics, you know, where you measure the chairs and you get people to sit at their desks right, and you can lower things and raise things to get the right furniture for them. And she wanted to build up a little team of people who could do the ergonomic assessments for her. So she put a shout out on Facebook or her network, and I said, oh, I'd have to give that a go. I fancy a bit of that. And a few weeks later, she wrote back saying, Joe, can we have a coffee? I thought, oh, great. So we said, having this coffee, and she said, Joe, it's not me. I think you're great, but I'm worried about my customers. What will they think of you if you turn up? I went, well, what do you mean? She said, well, you're trans, and what if they won't tell me that there's a problem. They'll just stop buying from me because of you. And I said, well, that's in your head, not in their head. And I coined this phrase, it's discrimination by proxy. It's not me, it's what other people think, and it will reflect on me. Actually, it's their own insecurity. And I said, well, how about I flip that around? What if they go, wow, you've got Joe. She's amazing. We've got trans people as well. We've got queer people. You're brilliant. You sent me into a university. You sent me into a public sector. Someone with a great D&I policy. So you just frame me as a challenge, not as an asset, as someone who could potentially turn customers on and not off. And she was so blocked by the what will people think of her, because it reflected on her. And I think a lot of D&I hires, you can trace back to that. If I hire a queer bloke, well, they think I'm queer, type thing, isn't it? Sort of, you know, what's wrong with you if you hire someone who's queer with pink socks?
yeah. And I still see elements of that, pockets of that. I mean, in the last year or so, as you know, because I've talked to you about some of this, I've done some bits and some events and some keynotes and emceeing some conferences where I've been very open about it. You know, I talk openly about my TikTok handle that I created was the bisexual granddad. You know, well, some people will like that, some won't. You know that I use a bit of innuendo occasionally, and some of that's a bit close to Julian Clary-esque type of innuendo. And I have a very firm view that if I use an innuendo and someone takes that to mean have a smutty or dirty meaning, well, that's in their mind, not mine, you know. And so that's got me more and more to a place of thinking, well, at the end of the day, I kind of screwed up the life that I had. That was on a trajectory to be looking and feeling everything like a typically successful, you know, upper working class family kind of life. Screwed that up, lost the people closest to me, went down that dark route of I could just throw it all in if I want to, and got to a place of like, well, what choice have I got left now? You know, as I wrote on a post a couple of years ago, I've got no more F's to give. When I'd completely run out of money and everything else, I ran out of those F's to give. You know what I mean, right? So, and that's where I've built back up from and gone, well, now my mission is to spread joy one smile at a time. You know, if somebody said to me, oh, you're wearing pink socks and pink laces, I go, oh, yeah, no, they're great, aren't they? And don't they go with the shirt? And I won't show you the color of my pants. you know, and have a little bit of and suddenly went all camp there when I did that. Did you notice? And I'll make a thing of it. And what it's done, actually, what I'm getting is a great response from people. And actually, particularly in the motor trade, and I'm becoming quite known for it. And if that is what I have to do as an ordinary bloke to give other people permission to be themselves, and that gradually, one smile at a time, gets joy back into the industry and back into what we're doing and gets them recruiting the right people, keeping the right people, then... You know, I'm probably not going to achieve it in my lifetime, but it's certainly not a bad place to be on the journey compared to where I was.
It's extremely stressful living your life by other people's rules. First of all, there's so many rules out there that different people have different rules. And when you're covering, masking, hiding, suppressing who you are, it's extremely exhausting. You know, we talked about, you know, you touched on psychological safety earlier. You touched on, you know, we talked about bringing your whole self to work, these kind of things. And when you're having to be this other person for other people's convenience, for their comfortability, it's a dark place, and it's a no win. And I always love the quote that Chris Evans, the BBC broadcaster who popped onto Top Gear for a while, he always said, you know, you've got to be Marmite. Half the world will love you and half the world will hate you, but the people who love you really, really love you. And I always think this is a great way of only getting inquiries from people who want to do business with you.
True.
If half the world don't like me or don't like what I stand for, who I am, that's great. I don't have to listen to them. Don't have to have that lecture.
Yeah.
Whereas people who engage with me love me for who I am. And I often think I'm very privileged that I go through the world as a trans woman, university, meeting people who I get on really well with, who have a lot of time for me. Mm. So I think polarizing the audience is a good thing. And I think being unashamedly you, with your pink socks, with whatever color underpants you're wearing that day, on the inside, maybe not on the outside, you get more work. And wouldn't you rather have work for who you are rather than for who they want you to be?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I got invited to an event about 18 months ago, and it was at the Royal Air Force Club in Piccadilly. Now, I thought, right, this is going to be like stepping back in time, right? And I did have at one point a hankering to go in the Royal Air Force and never did. But anyway, along came the memo, you know, with the requirements, you know, here's how how you dress and all the rest of it. And it was very, very strict. Men, lounge suits and a tie must be worn at all times in the building. So I looked at it and I thought, do you know what? At one point in my life and my career, I had probably 200 ties in my collection, and I was known for wearing ties that were, you know, a bit out there and all the rest of it. And I thought, I am not going to go to this event in a gray suit with a gray pinstripe tie and just look and sound like everyone else. So I found the loudest, brightest blue and pink paisley tie that I could find, and I deliberately wore it knowing that I would get a reaction, and it did. People saying, oh, you know, your tie is rather bold and all of that. And I go, yeah, look at me rainbow badge I'm wearing on my jacket as well. And funnily enough, it was accepted in the end, but it was almost a bit of a statement on my part that, you know, if I have to abide by your rules, I'm going to do that in my own way.
Hmm. Yeah, I look back and you think, all these dress codes, you know, all the as you say, black tie, white tie, wing collar, button down collars, all these kind of things, and patent shoes, Oxford, yeah, all this kind of, yeah. You think about all this and you think, so as a trans woman, what's my dress code? You know, I'm already turning up in a dress. I mean, that breaks half the mold and half the rules that you were imagining. So I then think, well, I'm going to say the F word, you know, fuck it, you know, who cares? You know, what's the point in trying to conform to a rule that I don't fit into in the first place? So,
yeah
but it takes, I don't know, there's a certain maturity or certain stage of your life where you are able to, just as you say, there are no more F's to give in this situation, where you've plateaued and found that you, and that you're prepared to just be that you without who cares who judges you now. I don't judge me all you like. I don't have to listen to your opinion or even respect it. I can just go, fine, this is more about you than it does about me.
Yeah.
But you get to that stage in life where you can live that way, can't you? And it was taking you a while to realize that.
Yeah, and I think anyone who, you know, I think I'm a bit older than you, aren't I? But we're a similar age group, aren't we? And you know, anyone who's grown up in the eras that we did, you know, you grew up being compliant to that, you know, looking, acting, sounding in a certain way based on the people around you. And, you know, and like you say, I made a living out of that. I made a lifetime out of doing exactly what I thought was expected. And, you know, if I have to wear a suit and I have to wear a tie, then I'm going to wear something that no one else is wearing that looks a bit more flamboyant than anyone else's. And I always did that. And like you say, now I'm just, you know what? All that time spent wondering what other people were thinking and who was judging me. Well, how did that turn out? Well, it didn't. I lost everything. So now I'm at the, well, I am what I am. If you don't like that, jog on.
You talked about bringing joy to the world and how that is kind of your new passion. You know, as you said, saving the world one smile at a time. How do you define joy? What does joy mean to you then?
Well, do you know what? I bounced this around a few friends over the weekend, and I had one, my best friend came back and said, oh, he said, I'm not sure about the word joy or joyful. He said, because it comes up with words of connotations of sort of, I guess he was getting at sort of a sexual nature and, you know, passion and all of that. And I was like, wow, that works even more for me. I think joy is about, you know, doing what makes you happy, you know, doing what makes you happy. And it doesn't matter, even if your circumstances are such that, you know, financially you have to be in a certain place or you have to be in a certain job, you know, you can still find ways of having joy or giving joy or participating in joy with other people and or whatever it might be. So, you know, I see people leaving what might be a fairly mundane job and then going and, you know, coaching a child's football team in the evening, you know, and they do that because it gives them immense joy. You and I are involved in the Professional Speaking Association. And, you know, as much as that may have its challenges at times, it gives us immense joy. We're around people who give freely and generously of the joy in their lives. And yeah, I mean, for me, I made that commitment to myself a year ago to only do what gives me joy. So if you're going to ask me to turn up and, you know, to an event and you're then going to start telling me what I can wear, what I can say, what I can do, how I have to act, that is going to suck the joy out of me. And I'm going to get to a point where I'm like, do I really want to do this?
Yeah. You're right. I always think about joy as being, where's the pop into my head of freedom. And what do I mean by freedom? It's not unbounded freedom, but it's freedom within broad parameters. And when I was going through my exploration and journey and coming out, I talked about the concept of cage, safari park, and Serengeti. Mm-hmm. So the cage is where you're living under someone else's rules, you know, you're by permission, having to behave, having to live in that restricted environment. Serengeti is where you're off piste, you're living in the wild, you know, trying to fight for your space in the waterhole, not getting eaten by a lion or something, or risk of poachers killing you or cutting your tusks off or whatever it may be. And the safari park is kind of a bit of half and half, where you've got fences, but they're miles apart. There's no predators in your cage, if you like. Someone chucks meat over and you can feast on that or whatever you eat. And you've got mates and friends and people to keep you happy. And so the fences are so far apart, you don't bump into them. Or if you do, they don't seem that restrictive anymore because you've got plenty of other ground. So my joy was finding my safari park. And that's the analogy I used, was to escape the cage, live within societal rules, broadly, because I don't want to be anarchic and go and live in the wild, and find in this safari park where I could coexist with others, with huge, great fences around, but no perceived barriers to the way I wanted to live. And so I completely understand your concept of joy. And I also have discovered sufficiency as a term as well. I don't need everything. I don't need to require bigger, faster, thicker, whatever it may be, whatever analogy. I'm looking for sufficient resources, food, money, comfort, love, house, whatever it may be, to enable that joy of freedom in my safari park, if you like. So yeah, it's reevaluating what's important. I think the earlier stages of my life was on this big up climb where you want stuff, don't you? You want bigger. I want to be impressive people with all this stuff. And now I just, joy is freedom and sufficiency for me.
Yeah, I love that. I'm probably going to nick that safari park analogy, if I may. But
published a blog. You're welcome to read it.
when I poked this word joyful out to a few friends, and loads of them came back and said, oh my God, that is so you. Yes, it's very much what you're about. But my best friend, who I trust, you know, more than anyone, came back and he went, yeah, I'm not sure about the word joyful. It means bliss, pleasure, peace, and passion. So I just wrote back and went, exactly. So he wasn't sure about the word joyful, but he answered the question for me of like, well, it's exactly what I'm getting at. And I mean, an example that I would use is that 2.5 years ago, I moved out of a very nice, large, detached house in a very nice area, you know, post the divorce, and moved into a small rented flat, you know, that overlooks a car wash. And I remember when I was back in the house, and we were there 20 years in that house, every Christmas would be the usual sort of, let's go around and give the neighbors their Christmas cards. And, you know, if you happen to catch one in the street as they were coming home and parking their car, you know, you'd go to stop and have a bit of a conversation. It'd be, oh, I haven't got time. I've got a dash. I'm going to doing this, or I'm going here, or got to run here, or whatever. And I never really noticed that before until I came here to this block of flats where there are a fairly transient population of people coming in and out renting. It's a lovely block of flats, beautiful flats, nice area, but it's got a good proportion of renters. I moved in here and on the 1st of October, and on the 1st of December, one of my neighbours knocked on the door and gave me a Christmas card and a bottle of wine, and she came in and we sat and had a chat for 2 hours. And I thought, in 20 years living in that really nice area where we were all competing over who's got the cleanest curtains, who drives the nicest car, who went on the best holiday, didn't have any of that. Moved to this place that's a lot more grounded and a lot more people not competing for attention, and everyone's just looking out for each other. It was lovely. So hence I'm in on the safari park thing.
I wonder, I'm just curious, this is me just checking my biases out here. So the people you sent the request for how does joy sound to you, were they mainly male identifying?
No, actually, just one of them was.
I'm just wondering, because is there a connotation where men aren't allowed to use the word joy? Is it a feminine connotation?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, possibly. But it was my business mentor on Saturday morning, actually, who said to me that he sees that the thread that runs between the three elements of my business, so Menable, me as a speaker, and me as an MC, the thread that runs through those are great experiences. Now, he said, I'm not overly keen on the word great. You have to think of another word for great. And it was me that came up with the word joyful. So for me, that's the thread that joins all three of them together. So whether you're an employer looking to up the ante on well-being in your business, that's about creating joyful experiences. Hiring me as a speaker is about inspiring people to have great experiences, or as an MC, creating a great event. And when I put that into a summary and sent that out to all my friends, interesting that most of my friends are women, isn't it? Which I think is fascinating. But anyway, I don't know if there's anything there. But when I sent that all out, yes, you're right. The only one who came back and questioned joyful was my male best friend.
Yeah, I mean, I quite relate to the word. And it's interesting you talk about joyful experiences. I mean, I've my mantra, or my kind of thing I promote, is positive people experiences. So yeah, it's not great. I use the word positive, and it's around creating that positive experience of interacting with me, interacting with your customers, interacting with your potential candidates in the hiring process, your stakeholders, whatever it may be. So yeah, it's making sure that every interaction you have from a people perspective is positive. Mm. And, you know, taking that analogy to you, then we're joyful. And I think that's a really positive, well, it's a joyful way of looking at the world.
Yeah. Well, one thing I did, I had run a conference, an awards night actually, before Christmas. And one of the little things that I do with my introduction is it involves a bit of confetti and glitter. And the event company, I met up with one of them for lunch last week. And she said to me, she said, you know, the hotel were cursing you and still are, because everywhere they look, they keep finding your glitter and your confetti. And I said, I know, even on the night, although I just threw a handful of it up on stage, it went everywhere. It just seemed to find its way into the gents, all over the stairs and so on and so on. So I said, well, that's what happens when you spread a little sparkle and a little stardust, right? Who knows where it's going to end up? Doesn't mean I'm going to stop doing it.
But I've seen you MC gigs and I've seen you on stage, and you always sort of reach into your suit pocket or your trouser pocket and you pull out some sparkles and cast them. And do you walk through life with glitter and sparkles in your pocket just in case?
Well, more and more times I think to myself I should do, but there's going to be a place where I'm going to do that and it's, you know, it's going to land in someone's coffee or it's I'm going to hack somebody off. But yeah, it wouldn't be a bad thing, actually. What a great experiment to try. I mean, try it on the tube or on a train or...
Yeah, you know, maybe if you've got biodegradable sort of modern wedding confetti sort of thing that doesn't stain and doesn't damage the planet or something, maybe.
Yeah, no, all of this is. The only thing I would say is that my flat is also full of it, because obviously where I've done exactly what you've said and put it in the pockets of trousers and jeans and so on is that I've now seem to have it everywhere. So it finds its way into the washing machine and under furniture. And
it's bad enough if you leave a tissue in the pocket of a dress.
Oh, I know.
And wash that. I mean, imagine, sort of having sparkles in the pocket of all your trousers. Yeah, that's going to be a real colourful experience.
Yeah, when you shake that out after taking it out the tumble dryer or whatever, it's,
Stephen, it's been absolutely fascinating. I mean, I'm glad we're friends and I'm glad we get to see each other on a regular basis. So it's been an honour to have you on the show today and hear about you bringing joy. And you may say you're just an ordinary bloke. I don't think you're an ordinary bloke. You have done extraordinary things. You've overcome extraordinary challenges in your life, and I'm sure you still will. And you've done that with a smile and with a purpose to bring joy. So thank you so much. How can people get hold of you?
Well, thank you for your very kind words as well. And the feeling's mutual, Joanne. You know, I think the world of you, So thank you for giving me the opportunity. But yeah, if anyone wants to get in touch, I'm all over LinkedIn, spreading stardust all over that platform, at Stephen J. Witton. That's Stephen with a PH, and Witton is WHITTON. My website is menable.org. That's menable.org. Or my main website, which needs to change because it doesn't reflect the sparkly stuff that we've just been talking about, is stephenjwitton.co.uk. So I'm very up for having chats and sprinkling a bit of stardust on whoever needs it.
Thank you. As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.